Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second episode of the AJSP Editors Podcast. This is Kim Pon Cham, and we have two more hosts here, Angela Learn and Sammy Khan. Just a reminder for our listeners and readers, this podcast series is a new initiative of the journal. We published 4 issues a year. In this very first year of the initiative, we will do 4 episodes of this podcast corresponding to the issues of the journal. 2 objectives doing this podcast. First, we see this as an opportunity for us to reach out to a wider audience so that we can introduce publications in our journal to a bigger community. The second is that we see this series as a platform for nurturing next generation of Asian social psychologists, where we share hopefully useful informative advice for students, for early career researchers. So these are the 2 objectives of doing this podcast. To achieve these 2 objectives, in each episode, we have 2 sections. The first section is the editor's pick, and the second one is a special topic discussion. All right. So without further delay, so let's begin with our editor's pick in this episode.
So the paper we've picked as the editor's pick for this podcast is Cultural Values in Chinese Proverbs Reported by Chinese College Students. And I think it's a really interesting and nicely conducted study or piece of research by Wang, Zhang, Coolidge, and Zhou. And it examined if and how proverbs used by Chinese college students reflected their cultural values. And the manuscript presents a 2-study mixed methods design, which is something that I particularly liked about this manuscript, and it combined both qualitative and quantitative research methods. So the basic premise of the paper then is if and how proverbs that we use represent our individual cultural values and those of the society within which we are living. So Kevin and Angela, can you think of any proverbs that you believe convey important messages or are just particularly interesting or peculiar?
I personally like this proverb, follow your own course and let people talk. I don't know whether it sounds really Chinese, right? I think that's also a question that I think the paper somehow asks, right? It doesn't sound very Chinese, but for me, this is something I subscribe to, right? I kind of reflecting from my life, I've made decisions that people basically disagree. I just took those paths and somehow, sometimes as success, sometimes failures. But it's something I personally subscribe to. I find it very interesting. And also find in this context, I think the question whether it is something really Chinese or not, I think that's also an interesting question from a research perspective, right? How about Angela?
Personally, I like this proverb, failure is the margin of success. I know it's a bit of cliche. I think a related proverb that originates in Western culture is with challenge comes opportunity. I like this proverb because I suppose this can resonate with a lot of academic researchers. As a researcher, failure is quite common. The papers that we submitted can often get rejected. So the study that we have planned for a long time, it didn't work out. The manipulation was not successful, so on and so forth. But I feel that these rejections can actually help us produce better quality paper in the future. So we can benefit from a lot of comments and feedbacks from the editor and the reviewers, and it can very much improve the next paper that you submit again. So I really live by this proverb. And also when I meet my students the first time, I tell them to prepare for an academic career, you have to have this mindset to be persistent and greedy. So I think this is something that I really believe in truly as a researcher. But apart from work, apart from my research, I have a passion in cooking, in baking. So when I bake something, the first trial is sometimes a failure. But with this first trial, I know how to improve the ingredients, how to control the temperature better, how to revise the recipes. So the next trial is often more successful. So apart from work, I also find this proverb to be very applicable in my hobby and in my interests.
Thank you. And I think that actually relates to one of my favorite ones, which isn't actually listed in this paper, but that is don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And that's all about, you know, retaining that which is good in perhaps a bad situation. And I think that also relates for me to research, when not everything works the way that we want it to work, but there are still good aspects left in the design and the data that we may retain and do something with. But I'm going to go back to the paper here. And as mentioned earlier, the study was set in China. It consisted of two studies, a qualitative and a quantitative study, and data was collected from college students. So in the first study, which was a qualitative study, 298 college students were sampled, and they were then asked to write down 8 Chinese proverbs that they thought conveyed values that were important to them. Through this exercise, a total of 882 proverbs were listed by the participants. After they'd collected these proverbs from the participants, the authors then checked if the proverbs in fact were legitimate proverbs using a variety of authoritative texts on proverbs in China and around the world. And this was then followed by sorting the listed proverbs based on frequency and categorizing the proverbs according to dominant values that they conveyed. And this was a particularly important aspect of the sorting exercise. And again, they used a range of authoritative texts for this step in terms of categorizing the proverbs based on the values conveyed by them. Based on this exercise and the application of Kenny's binomial distribution formula, the researchers identified 103 legitimate and frequently listed proverbs. And so these were proverbs that were listed by 4 or more participants. And these 103 frequently listed proverbs were in turn categorized under 4 general themes using thematic analysis. And the 4 general themes represented 8 more specific values. The first general theme included proverbs about achievement orientation. And an example of a proverb under this general category is knowledge is power. And this general theme then, achievement orientation, included proverbs that conveyed 3 more specific values or sub-values. The first one was learnedness, which is about placing emphasis on learning, education, and knowledge. Secondly, diligence, being about valuing dedication and hard work. And thirdly, practical orientation, which is about one's willingness and readiness to apply oneself to set goals. So that was the first general theme. And the second general theme was social harmony. And an example of a proverb under this theme is, where many help to gather firewood, the flames shoot high. This second general theme also included proverbs that were embedded in 3 more specific values. And the first value was collective orientation, which is about a focus on groups and collectivities. And the second value was social relationships, stressing the importance of interpersonal interconnectedness. And the third value was moral virtue, being about the promotion of specific standards regarding behavior and character. The third general theme was free spirit. This theme included proverbs that were embedded with values about freedom of action and the absence of coercion, constraint, and imposition. And an example proverb from this free spirit theme was, follow your own course and let people talk. The fourth and final general theme was optimism. And an example of a proverb under this category is, winter has come, will spring be far away. And the authors then were able to link these values to Chinese cultural traditions that have their origins in Confucian and Taoist philosophy, but also some Western philosophy. So they used a lot of authoritative works on proverbs and philosophical traditions and tried to map onto that. But having mapped out the latent value structure of frequently used proverbs among Chinese college students, the researcher conducted a cross-sectional survey study in which they asked 240 college students to indicate the extent to which they agreed with the 103 proverbs. Participants were also asked to indicate their individualistic versus collectivistic value orientations using Truandis's 24-item INTCOL scale. And it's also worth mentioning here that the internal reliability for the proverbs or the proverb clusters range from good to excellent. So actually, they did correspond to the categories that the researchers had defined for these proverbs. They then ran a series of repeated measures, ANOVAs, and follow-up t-tests on the data and found that participants endorsed the proverbs conveying practical orientation and learnedness the most, followed by diligence, moral virtues, social relationships, collective orientation, optimism, and free spirit. So in other words, participants endorsed proverbs concerning practical orientation and learnedness the most, and optimism and free spirit the least. Still, in a series of regression analysis, they then found that both individualistic and collectivistic values predicted endorsement of the 8 value domains of proverbs. So that means that the endorsement of both individualistic and collectivistic values explained unique variants in the endorsement of the 103 proverbs. Collectivistic values were somewhat more predictive than individualistic values, but not much more so. I think they were quite equally predictive. So it seems then, even in a globalized local environment, that young Chinese people find ways to accommodate ancient Chinese wisdom with individualistic culture orientations, but also vice versa. So, for example, some proverbs representing having a free spirit, which more typically would be associated with individualistic values, were in fact associated with collectivistic value orientations among these participants. So in the discussion, the authors proposed that this seeming contradiction is indicative of the development of hybrid cultural orientations among young Chinese, allowing them to accommodate both individualistic and collectivistic values. And they also speculate that young Chinese may find novel ways of making sense of Chinese cultural values and applying them in their day-to-day lives. So even though that they're going through this globalizing, modernizing kind of process, they're still able to maintain their traditional Chinese values, but also perhaps interpret them and making sense of them and applying them in original and novel ways. Mm-hmm. So that's essentially my summary of the paper. Angela, was there anything that you liked about the paper? Any strengths to the paper?
Yeah, I have a few things that I liked the paper a lot. So as Sammy also mentioned, I also like the fact that the research triangulated with both qualitative and quantitative approaches to study dominant proverbs in Chinese culture. And I also like it that the researchers try to dissect the associated cultural values and cultural meanings of these proverbs among Chinese college students. And particularly for the qualitative part, I really like the very comprehensive and systematic content analysis. They also actually have a cross-check with Chinese language experts to identify the axioms or values reflected by the proverbs. So I think that qualitative part was very nicely done. And another part I find it very interesting is the research also showed evidence that young people in China endorse both collectivism and individualism. And there's also actually a trend that these young people embrace individualism more than collectivism. So I think this point has been talked about by people. They mentioned that young people in China seem to be more individualistic now as compared to the older generations, maybe due to the one-child policy in the past or because of the increased exposure to Western influences. So I think this research defined evidence that there is a tendency for young people in China to be actually more individualistic than collectivistic. But at the same time, with that said, they still preserve the traditional Chinese cultural values. So I think that is also very interesting. And this made me think about probably these young people may have the dual self-constructs. That means they may have the independent self as well as the interdependent self, the two selves actually applicable and accessible in different situations. And on a broader level, broader societal level, it also showed that modernization and globalization has resulted in a balanced and hybrid form of cultural experiences for young Chinese people. So they can exhibit both individualistic as well as collectivistic values and practices in a way that is situationally appropriate. So I think that is a very intriguing part of the study. And I also feel that studying proverbs is a great tool for cultural psychologists to study cultural meanings and cultural experiences for people in different countries. So that is my take on the paper. So Kevin, what do you think? What do you like about this research?
I strongly agree with you too in terms of the design of the study. I personally like mixed methods research pretty much. I like the combination of qualitative and quantitative studies, because there are a lot of things that we can't study quantitatively. Because when you do quantitative studies, you have to start with some assumptions, the researcher's assumptions, and then you measure those things or you manipulate those things. But if you don't have a good idea about what those things are, you can't manipulate them, you can't measure them, right? So you have to start with a qualitative study and then follow up with a quantitative study. I think that kind of sequence, I like this kind of research design very much. And of course, I would like to applaud the authors for the effort they put into the qualitative analysis in study, in the first study, in study one. I did things like this before, and I can tell you it was extremely tedious and time-consuming, right? Just to process the open-ended responses and then code them, categorize them, make sense of them. These efforts are really, really difficult. So I would like to say thanks to the authors for making this effort. Another thing I like is the theoretical angle here. Angela mentioned, using proverbs as a window of understanding the culture of a community, of a group of people. I think this is an interesting angle of analysis. And the findings are also telling of the hybridization, right, in the contemporary context. I like this idea. I think this is very true. Culture is never a very static entity. There's a lot of branding, mixing, hybridization, and we're observing perhaps more and more of these type of hybridization in different parts of the world, and how people know to follow up these two systems or even multiple systems of thinking within the same mind. I think that's something very intriguing to me. I think that's, of course, what I think cultural psychology is very interested in, right? So overall, I like this research in both in terms of the theoretical angle and the research design used.
Yes, and I would agree with both of you, and particularly relating to Kevin's point here about the work that goes into a qualitative study like that. And perhaps those who are experienced in research can see that, but if you're not perhaps familiar with the process, it perhaps looks simpler than it actually is. But there's a lot of work that goes into it. But that's what I actually like about the paper, the simplicity of it. They actually make it look very simple what they've done. But everyone who's engaged in research understand how much time and effort must have gone into that qualitative component. Angela, do you think there are any ways in which this paper or the research that underpinned the manuscript could potentially be improved?
Yeah, I think one thing that the authors also mentioned in the discussion part is they can consider expanding the sampling frame to middle age and older populations in order to compare differences with the young generations, right? Because the current sampling is the university students. Another thing that they may improve on could be to further distinguish the sources of proverbs. Because currently, according to the paper, they actually categorize the proverbs into different groups. So they have Asian literacy quotes, they have Chinese translation of Western sayings, they have Chinese folk adages, contemporary slogans, and some social media buzzwords. So I think this is a very great categorization of different sources of proverbs. I think it would be very insightful if the authors can further compare the value differences between traditional and contemporary proverbs. For example, I'm quite interested to see what kind of themes are more likely to categorize those contemporary slogans and social media buzzwords as compared to the themes reflected in the traditional proverbs or idioms. So maybe these further categorizations can provide us even more information about the change in culture across time. So I think these two things can be areas for improvement. Kevin, do you have any other suggestions?
Yeah, but before answering that question from Sammy, is it a thunderstorm in Singapore?
Is the thunderstorm very loud? Is it quite bad?
No, that's fine. Just let the listeners and readers know we are from different countries, right? in Singapore, Sammy in Sweden, and I in Hong Kong. So we are using Zoom, actually, right? Doing this recording. We are from different countries, different time zones, right? just wondering whether listeners are curious about what's the sound.
Yeah, this is about the time Singapore has
the
thunderstorm and the rain.
afternoon, right?
Yeah, late afternoon.
Right. All right, back to the question. Yeah, improvement, right? Suggestion for improvement. I agree with Angela. The very first thing I was thinking of is the sampling, of course. I think expanding these different age groups, it's an interesting direction, just as Angela mentioned. But I think another way of expanding the sample representation is to include people who are less educated, because the authors use students who are taking university programs or courses, right? These are supposedly more educated young people. They're possibly cognitively more sophisticated, they may have more elaborate exposure to proverbs and more kind of complex representation of values. So I'd be quite interested in seeing what happens if we use people who are similar young people, but who are less educated, and whether we find similar structure in terms of the values or in terms of the themes identified in the proverbs. So that's my view.
Angela, do you have any thoughts about future directions?
I think the topic would be a very excellent way to further study intergenerational transmission of cultural values. I think one thing I can think of is to study parent-children diet. So we can ask parents what kind of proverbs they want their children to live by or embrace. And similarly, we can ask the children what proverbs they themselves agree and they embrace, right? So I think similarities between the parent-children weighting would mean that those values or those proverbs are shared and are compatible between the parents and the children. And it is likely that these values are passed down from some sort of intergenerational cultural transmission. However, but if there are differences, if there are discrepancies between parent-child weightings, that would mean that those values are not shared between the parents and the children. And these values are likely to be the source of intergenerational conflicts and disagreements. So this could be extended as an area to study these types of intergenerational transmission of cultural values. So there's a lot of potential for further studying this area of research about proverbs. So that's my perspective for further studying this research. So Kevin, do you have any other directions to share?
Yeah, I was also thinking about parents and children. And of course, identifying similarities or differences, I think that would be quite interesting. I think to frame it in a different way, I would also be interested in seeing how parents prioritize these different proverbs. If these are things that they want to transmit to their children, if these are things that they want to teach their children, you know, proverbs often used in the kind of educational messages, whatever. So I'm quite interested in seeing how parents, Chinese parents, for example, how they rank these different proverbs in terms of these importance of being conveyed to or transmitted to their offspring. And you can ask the same questions to teachers, right? Teachers in schools, right? Which value is embodied in these proverbs are considered to be important that we want our future generations of Chinese people to pick up, to endorse, to subscribe to. So it, to some extent, touches on the topic of socialization strategies or socialization goals. I think using proverbs could be a better way compared to just abstract value words or abstract statements. The proverbs are relatively, you know, most people understand, they're supposedly easy to understand. So using proverbs as a tool to capture these type of psychological processes might be an interesting direction compared to using very abstract sentences or abstract words. That's one of my thoughts. And another thought I have is that relationship between proverbs and values and behavior. Behavior is not the focus of this paper we're discussing, but I'm very interested in seeing to what extent people act out these proverbs they subscribe to what extent they really use these proverbs to guide their own behaviors, to what extent the proverbs provide them with the perseverance or motivations to deal with setbacks, for example. I personally mentioned to you the proverb I like a lot, and so that I really refer to that when I was facing difficult decisions. That's a standard sentence I have in my mind. So, and that reminds me that, okay, I know my principles. I know what I want to do. So just do it. So I'm curious how young people in the Chinese society nowadays, to what extent these proverbs are being used in the way they deal with their study or deal with their relationships with others, etc. Yeah, the behavior, relationship with behavior, a direction that is worth pursuing, I suppose.
Well, it was a really interesting paper, and it is the editor's pick, so we would encourage everyone, to read the whole second issue of the AGSP. But, you know, we obviously recommend this paper in particular. It does stimulate a lot of thinking around proverbs and wisdom and you know, what application they have in our day-to-day lives, and made me very curious about how these dynamics may play out in other cultures as well, the functions that proverbs actually serve. But I think that concludes at least the editor section, and I'll pass the microphone over. Well, we all have separate microphones, but I'll pass it over to Kevin.
So that ends the editor's pick section. So that, please stay, right? We'll be back in a minute with the special topic discussion. Okay, hello everyone. Welcome back to this second episode, the second section, which is special topic discussion. Listeners and readers, if you remember last time we did discussion on COVID-19, which is of course a very timely topic. This time our topic is climate change, another very urgent issue that humans are facing. We have a very special guest today, Susan Clayton. He's here with us. Hi, Susan.
Hi, glad to be here.
I think Susan is the best person to talk about psychology and climate change. She is currently Whitmore Williams Professor of Psychology at the College of Worcester. She has published many books, articles about the relevance of psychology to the understanding of climate change, including articles in American Psychologist, in Nature Human Behavior. And she recently edited a book with Christine Manning. The book title is Psychology and Climate Change, Human Perceptions, Impacts, and Responses, which is a book I highly recommend to anyone who is interested in understanding psychology and climate change. This is the book that you can start with. And she's also the lead author on the upcoming sixth assessment report from the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change. And as everyone knows, this is a very, very important report by the panel, right? So we're happy that we have psychologists and particularly Susan to be a lead author on this report. So I think my introduction should stop here, because if you're just introducing Susan, we need a lot of time. I better stop here, save more time for our discussion. I always want to start with a question about our guest. This is a question about how they started the journey with social psychology. Definitely something you can't find on their CV, all right? So the question, my very first question to Susan is, how did you fall in love with psychology?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And thanks for that very complimentary introduction. It was while I was an undergraduate student, I knew that I was interested in psychology, even though I didn't have a very good sense of what psychology was. I think like a lot of students at that age, you know, you don't know a lot about all the different areas of psychology. And I had a course in social psychology my first year at college. Mm-hmm. And the instructor was just very good. And I was fascinated by all the research he told us about. It was the fact that normal people behaved in such, you know, surprising and irrational ways, I think, mm-hmm. that really hooked me. And then at the end of the course, the instructor issued a sort of general invitation to students to get involved in research with him. And I thought, oh my gosh, everybody's going to want to do this. You know, I better sign up quickly. And it turned out there were only two of us who volunteered, which now being a professor, I know is quite typical. But so I had the opportunity to get involved in research right away. And I'm sure that involvement in designing studies and collecting data and looking at the data is really what cemented me into the field of social psychology.
So inspiring teachers.
Absolutely. And I realize I should add, so my professor's name was Neil Lutzky, and he has gotten teaching awards from psychology, and he's been the president of the Society for the Teaching of Psychology. So he really was very good at his job.
That's something I aspire to be, to be an inspiring teacher for my students, right? And you never know what your students will become in future, right? Thanks for sharing with us your story. So now back to the discussion, the topic today, climate change, right? Social psychology and climate change. I'm not sure about others, but when I first started in research in this area, I knew nothing about it. And I was quite actually just curious how social psychology is really relevant to climate change, right? So I think this is a very good opportunity for us, you know, and for our listeners and readers to learn something about the relevance of social psychology to the issue of climate change, right? We have some questions for you, Susan, right? Angela, maybe you can start first.
Yeah. So as Kevin mentioned, when I first started researching on climate change, I also tried to see how my background in social psychology and cultural psychology can contribute to the study of climate change. And I know many of the readers of AJSP, many of them are social or cultural psychologists. So I think many of us, including me, would be very interested to know from your perspective, how is social psychology relevant to studying climate change? And how can a social or cultural psychologist contribute to studying topics related to climate change or other sustainability issues? So Susan, can you tell us your take about these questions?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm actually going to start by maybe returning a little bit to what Kevin said about not knowing very much about the area. And I, too, you know, knew nothing about this area when I started because there were no social psychologists or, you know, really studying climate change, I think, probably until this century. Certainly, there were very few of them. And I didn't learn anything about psychology and environmental issues throughout my training. And so I say that in part to encourage listeners who also may have no training in climate change, you know, that it doesn't matter. You don't need to have been trained in it. You can come to the area and really start to explore it if it interests you. I think that where people started was a recognition that climate change, you know, as others have said, it's not an environmental problem. It's a human problem. It's a problem of human behavior is one of the first things people recognize. So social psychologists know a lot about behavior. They know a lot about predictors of behavior. They know a lot about behavior change. One of the very first things I learned about was kind of the weak connection between attitudes and behavior and then things that might increase that connection. So I think a lot of social psychologists started in with that idea of studying, you know, pro-environmental behavior and ways to increase pro-environmental behavior. But then we also, you know, we social psychologists, I think, expanded to think about things like motivation, persuasion, values, identity. So all of those issues that relate to not just specific behaviors with regard to like, do people choose to recycle? Do they choose to install solar panels and so on? But, you know, what is the broader context in which people are making these behavioral choices? You know, how do they think about the natural environment, what matters to them, you know, what are their values and how do those stem from their self-perceptions and their identity? So I think those are some really, you know, just very basic foundations of social psychology that are relevant to and can be applied to studies about climate change.
Yeah, I totally agree, Ray. So social psychologists are very interested to study the attitude change or behavioral change. And I think this is the key for studying climate change, because eventually we hope people can do something to mitigate or adapt to environmental changes. So maybe a follow-up question to you, Susan. So as I mentioned, our readers are social or cultural psychologists, right? And probably they are quite familiar with a lot of established findings in social psychology, so such as social norms, conformity, attitude, interpersonal relationships, how situation or context influences our behaviors. Right? So these are very established findings in the area of social psychology. So what are some of these very well-known findings or results in social psychology that can add a novel perspective to the area of environmental psychology? So how can we integrate the two areas?
I'll just echo what you just say and said, one of the most important thing I think social psychology adds is this awareness of situational influence, because a lot of people who are not psychologists who might be trying to promote sustainable behavior, you know, they're very focused on information, give people information, tell them about the impacts of their behavior, or maybe financial incentives, which are not irrelevant, but in many cases have so much less power than more immediate situational factors like what other people are doing. So I think definitely those are some of the most important findings that social psychologists have contributed to. Now, integrating those is a different challenge. I don't know if you're talking specifically about, you know, talking with other people to actually apply interventions, but I would say that that's one thing social psychologists have to learn to do better, to learn to do more. And I think most of us get little or no training in this, but not just doing the research, you know, publishing the research and hoping that somebody reads it, but actually finding ways to implement that in applied settings. And that's a real challenge. But I will also add that I think it's very motivating to people. I've talked to a lot of social psychology graduate students who are so excited about the idea that their research might actually make a difference as opposed to just, you know, be published and get them a job.
So is more than kind of just integrating different areas of psychology, but no, you're talking about bridging the gap between researchers and practitioners, how to translate our work, research findings into something that are practical, that are useful. And I think definitely involves collaboration with practitioners, right?
Absolutely. And I don't mean to discredit basic research. I would say most of my research counts as basic research, so it doesn't all have to be applied. But I think probably all of us who are working in this area have chosen it because we know it's important and not just because it's theoretically interesting. So to at least have in the back of the mind the idea that when we choose our research questions or our research methods, we can be thinking, is there potential impact of this research? And if so, how can I bring it to the attention of those who might be able to do something about it?
I think it shows that it is a difference, a distinct feature of the social psychological study of climate change. In it is that, you know, it has this applied focus. Of course, we develop theories for this understanding, but at the back of our mind, we want to develop something that is really useful. We actively look for opportunities that, you know, we can make use of through research findings. That might be a little bit different from some other areas of research. I don't know, maybe, for example, you're studying interpersonal relationships or member relationships. There might be application or value, but I think when you're asking questions like how to motivate people, behaviors, change, exactly, there must be a real-world issue you want to solve, right? And then you see opportunities of applying those knowledge. So that makes it quite natural that when you look for collaboration with practitioners, external organizations.
Yeah, and I guess I would also say, and I point this out because sometimes there is this perceived tension between basic and applied research, right? And that, you know, basic research is, you know, sometimes given higher status, you know, in the major universities. But I would say a lot of social psychological research does have this evaluative component. So you have lots and lots of people working on prejudice and racism, for example, and they're not just curious, they would like to reduce prejudice and reduce racism and reduce discrimination. Yeah. You have people working on predictors of aggression, and they would like to be able to limit aggression and prevent it from becoming problematic. So I think when you study social behavior, at some point, awareness of potential outcomes and impacts of your work is going to be something that occurs to you. But again, climate change is so urgent that I think there's that additional perspective on it.
Hi, Susan. Yeah. I'm just going to ask a few questions about social psychology, and they're actually quite related to Angela's last questions. I'm wondering if you're able to describe the or perhaps some of the major theories and research findings in the social psychology of climate change, or in other words, if you can talk perhaps broadly about the main theoretical and empirical contributions made by social psychology to understanding and addressing climate change.
Yeah, and I think probably almost everybody would agree with what I would say as one of the top ones, which is the theory of planned behavior. You know, this is a model, gosh, I can't remember when it was published, maybe in the 90s, that grew out of an earlier model, the theory of reasoned action, that was published maybe as far ago as the 70s, and provides a formula. I'm sure many of the listeners are aware of it, you know, a formula for explaining behavior. And it isn't perfect, but it has been, you know, validated in probably hundreds of studies. And I think it's very helpful both for, you know, for researchers interested in expanding the theory to think, well, when do these models that, you know, basically have to do with attitudes and social norms and beliefs and values, when do these predict behavior and what might be missing? So, for example, focusing on identity-related factors and how that might add to the theory of planned behavior is an area of interest. But it's also been very useful for people developing applied interventions. It's, you know, it's like they could say, okay, I need to pay attention to social norms and to attitudes and think about, you know, how to use those in my model. And then Paul Stern's value belief norms model, you know, perhaps just slightly less so than the theory of planned behavior, is also one that's been used a lot with more explicit attention, I think, to the role of values.
Are you witnessing any trends in the social psychology of climate change? So, for example, are you seeing any emerging topics and/or research priorities?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this special issue of AJSB is illustrates one trend, which is increasing awareness of the importance of cultural differences and the need to, you know, especially because climate change is a global problem, the need to be aware of cultural differences. Of course, we need to be aware of people's different exposure to climate change in different parts of the globe, certainly, but also cultural differences that might predict the way they respond, you know, their attitudes and the role of social norms. So looking at things like individualism and collectivism. And I say this as an American researcher, one of the things that's been so significant in predicting climate change attitudes in the US has been political orientation. And that has very different, you know, there are places in the world where it's still influential, but not quite as much, and other places where the political significance of climate change is just completely different. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been an important reminder to us that there are so many cultural differences that are relevant to understanding how people respond to climate change and will also help us to advance theory about, you know, the role of culture in general.
Maybe I can ask a follow-up questions on that. So in addition to naming some emerging topics in this area of research, do you see any gaps there? Do you see areas or topics that we haven't adequately addressed yet, areas for which we need more research? What are these gaps here?
Yeah, great question. And this is one I wasn't sure whether to call it an emerging trend, but maybe a gap would be a better way of describing it. Looking at how climate change and environmental changes in general will affect social behavior. I think there's been really very little research on this, but just some beginning studies that have started to look at it. And yet, I mean, some of it we know that, you know, climate change will increase. It's most associated with increased temperatures. And we, of course, have this decades of research on the relationship between warmer temperatures and aggression. So it's not that difficult to see a connection there, but some of other kind of provocative research suggesting that just thinking about climate change, you know, has impacts on the way in which people think about out-groups, for example. So I really hope that we'll have more research of the impacts of climate change on social behavior.
So just now, Susan mentioned the special issue in AJSP, right? Just in case some readers or listeners don't know yet, we just published a special issue on the social psychology of climate change in the Asian context in a journal. There are 7 empirical articles and also a systematic review. So let me ask maybe a question about the special issue specifically, just because Susan just mentioned the special issue. I just want to ask you about your overall impression of this collection of articles we have in the special issue, okay? I just mentioned there are several empirical articles. It's one systematic review. What is your overall impression of this collection of these articles? What is the significance of these collection of articles, et cetera?
For me, what's very important about it is the diversity of topics that are represented, and I think not coincidentally also diverse in methodology. It sort of reflects that idea of cultural difference that there are really some, when you start to think about climate change in some of the countries that have been understudied, it does raise new questions and also, I think, again, suggest the need for new methodologies. And another thing I'll say about the special issue is that, you know, if you look at the papers as a whole, you know, they do pay attention to these sort of specific facts about climate change locally, but also they clearly employ social psychological theory and can help us to advance theory. So that's a really nice, you know, reflection of that in that way. I will say they weren't quite as diverse as maybe we had originally hoped they would be there, because maybe there's not as much work across the Asian context on mm-hmm. climate change. So I think, not to belittle what there is, but I think it would be good if there were even more diversity, you know, a broader range of people from different areas using kind of different tools to study different relevant topics.
Yeah.
So I think what that shows us is we still need to make progress on encouraging more people to do research in this area.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's one of the goals of adding this special issue, right, in the journal. I encourage the party to kind of showcase what exists and also, of course, encourage more people to join this area of research, right? And that definitely there's some gaps there, even in this mm-hmm. special issue. There are certain areas, even within Asia, there's certain areas that are kind of underrepresented. So hopefully the special issue can serve as a kind of stimulation or inspiration for researchers in these different areas. I just want to ask one more question about a special issue. That's that among the papers, that which paper or which finding interests you most? Anything that you want to recommend to the readers, listeners?
Oh, gosh. Well, I would hate to be responsible for, you know, singling out a particular paper, you know, as the one most worthy of paying attention to. I guess I would comment on two, though, that drew my attention. One is, and you were involved in it, Kevin, so but I don't know how to pronounce the first author's first name, Yilha. Is that Kirsti Yilha or Jilha? And I liked that study in particular because it looked at, you know, the relationship between kind of the perceived relationship between humans and nature. Mm-hmm. So do people perceive humans as dominant over nature? And that's just always been an interest of mine. It's how people view that relationship between humans and nature. So think about the relevance of that to perceptions of climate change. Mm-hmm. And of course, that study was also useful because it had three different samples from three different countries. So some nice comparisons available there. But the other study that I thought was very interesting was by Kumar and Sarthi on sort of solastalgia in rural India. Mm-hmm. And I liked that one because it was such a different methodology and, you know, the kind of thing I have no personal experience of. So getting that, it was a very qualitative study of people's perceptions of environmental changes and kind of their emotional reactions to that. So that kind of study is just really useful to me, you know, personally, and to think to all of us in expanding our understanding of how climate change is being experienced.
Yeah, I think if I was pressed to really pick one paper, the paper by Kumar and Sati is also a paper that I would pick, just as Susan mentioned, the use of the qualitative method and also a very rich description of how people experience climate change. It not only serves the kind of academic purpose of developing theoretical understanding of people's experience of climate change, but I think it also kind of provides kind of a very humanistic angle to the issue of climate change. You really learn something about how climate change is impacting humans' life and their livelihood and the lived experience, which can actually serve as stories that we can use to communicate to people about the urgency and severity of climate change. So that's the reason I like the paper a lot.
Yeah. I actually want to ask Susan another question that is also related to this paper by Kuma. So as Kevin mentioned, they look at this concept called solastalgia. And recently I came across Susan's paper on Journal of Environmental Psychology about climate change anxiety. So I think these concepts are quite related. So maybe I can use this opportunity to ask Susan to introduce to us what this concept of climate change anxiety is about.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's definitely a new and emerging area, and it's really kind of at the borders of social psychology and more of a clinical psychology. But recognizing that, you know, climate change doesn't just affect people who are directly experiencing it, its effects, but it affects all of us through our perceptions of climate change as a problem. And I was motivated to start looking at this because there's so much media attention to the idea that people are experiencing eco-anxiety, or as you suggested, there are multiple terms that are in use. Solastalgia is the earliest that I'm aware of. They don't mean exactly the same thing, but they all get at the idea of emotional distress associated with the perception of a changing environment. And what I tried to do in my research was to see, is there any evidence that this maybe has clinical significance, that it's, you know, interfering with people's quality of life and their ability to work or to sleep or to socialize? I think it won't surprise people to say it's a fairly small percentage of people who are experiencing it at this level, but there do seem to be some people for whom that's the case. So, you know, I'm continuing to look at that question. And one of the things I want to know is, well, what leads this sort of anxiety to be turned inwards and become dysfunctional, and what leads it to maybe be turned outwards and motivate action?
Yeah, it seems to me it's a pretty new area to branch into, like clinical psychology, mental health issues, and psychological being, right? To look at how climate change can affect our psychological health. So I think this is a very good new direction to pursue.
I just want to say, I hope our listeners and readers, through the discussion so far, they can appreciate how important it is, the social psychology is for the understanding of climate change. And I hope some of them would find some stimulation in it, and then may also find some motivation in starting their own research in the area. So I just want to end the discussion with a question to Susan. For someone who is completely new to the social psychology of climate change, it could be a student, it could be a researcher, but they're new to this area, what is the best starting point?
I'll just give my perspective on this, and there may be other answers, but because it's so new, I think one good thing is just to become informed, to read widely. And I think, you know, certainly that's what happened in my case, that I didn't sort of start out thinking, this is where I want to go, this is what I want to study. I just was paying attention to things that interested me, took an environmental studies course, tried to talk to people who are not psychologists, and, you know, gradually the thread started to come together. But for people who have a little bit more sense, yes, I do want to do, you know, climate change and psychology. If you're a student, there are not necessarily particular programs that you need to go to specialize, but find some researchers whose work interests you. Because again, it could vary so widely from, you know, applied behavioral interventions to understanding impacts of, you know, natural and degraded environments to risk perception. So find some questions that interest you and the people who are actually doing that research and follow them, and maybe, you know, reach out to them and see if they're teen graduate students, if you're a student, or reach out to them and see if they want to collaborate if you're not a student, and just kind of see where it leads you. But the other thing I would suggest is for people to think about how applied they want to be. So I talked about the applications as being very motivating, but again, there's a lot of important basic work that's also being done. So for a person who knows they want to be actually involved in on-the-ground projects that are making a difference, that might suggest a different set of skills that you would need to pick up versus if what you really want to do is advance the basic research that enlightens us about how people are relating to the natural environment.
All right, thanks a lot for these very valuable advice. I hope our listeners and readers can find some insights in it. And also, of course, from this special topic discussion. So I think this way I want to conclude this special topic discussion. Of course, once again, we need to thank Susan for taking the time to join us, share her experience, her ideas with us about social psychology of climate change. Thanks a lot, Susan.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Susan.
This also comes to the end of this second episode of the podcast. Listeners and readers, stay tuned. See you in the third episode. Bye-bye.